You're listening to a program produced in 2017 by Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place at the historic Central Library in downtown Los Angeles. Aloud is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more, please visit lfla.org/aloud.
Michelle T. will be introducing our guests, but it's my honor to introduce her. Michelle T. is the author of the recent dystopic fiction memoir, Black Wave, as well as 9 other books of memoir, fiction, and poetry. She's also a tireless advocate for creating literary community, be it through Radar Productions, a nonprofit and literary series she founded in San Francisco that gives voice to innovative queer and outsider writers, or through creating the first all-girl poetry open mic roadshow in the 90s, known as Sister Spit, now celebrating its 20th anniversary this year. T is also the editor of Amethyst Editions, an imprint of Feminist Press, and she's recently made Los Angeles her new home. So we are very happy to give Michelle and all of our guests a warm welcome to Los Angeles and the LA Public Library.
Hello, everybody. I would like to thank the library for allowing me to live out my dream of being a talk show host. Thank you. I've done many events in my life, and this is always exactly where I wanted to be sitting. And so it feels really good. It feels as good as I thought that it would. So thank you so much for being here. You know, I put this program together many months ago, and was intrigued by the idea of talking with other writers about the ideas of fear and loathing and anxiety and the ways that writers and artists handle their anxiety in their work, the way that being an artist can kind of produce a certain kind of anxiety in a person. And then as I was brainstorming all the great things we were going to talk about, the election happened and Armageddon began. And now we have an entirely different slate of things to feel anxious and loathing and fearful of. So the questions will change a little bit. But we have 3 amazing writers that are here today and artists who've dealt in some way within their work with ideas of anxiety. And so I'm really happy to have them here and get to talk to them. And you'll get to talk to them too. And our first writer is also a comedian. It's Sarah Benincasa. She is the author of the books Great, Agora Fabulous, and Real Artists Have Day Jobs, among others. That's a sampling. So we're going to bring her up here right now, and she's going to read for you. Please welcome Sarah Benincasa.
Wow. Thank you so much. This is so exciting. My mom is a librarian. So she like lost it, yeah. She was like, that's so exciting that you're performing at the Taper Forum. I was like, it's not the Taper Forum. Like it's a little different. That's not inside the library. Like, yes, Los Angeles is very glamorous, but it doesn't have, I was like, it's fine. So I sent her and my dad a picture of the sort of main atrium and they were like, are you at a mall? And I was like, all right, New Jersey, it's 10:30 there, go to bed. This is very intense for you, I get it. So this is actually my first book, Agora Fabulous, Dispatches from My Bedroom. And this came out in 2012. If I could write it again, I would do some things differently, but I can't. So I picked I love it. I still love the book, I should say that. But in reading it, it's very strange because, you know, I wrote it when I was like 30 and, you know, just a girl. And some things have changed, but it remains a true account of my life and my struggle with anxiety and with agoraphobia, which is on the anxiety spectrum. So the Women's March for me as an agoraphobic person was quite an adventure. I started to have a panic attack in the middle of this is a short reading. Everyone calm down. So I started to have a panic attack And I noticed somebody else who was like breathing really high in her chest and looked like how I felt inside. And I was like, that's my new best friend. So I grabbed her and she told me she was uncomfortable being in the crowd. I was like, me too, let's go. And so it was me, her, and then her roommate. Cut to, they just met 3 weeks ago. They're both named Angie. We went and split a bottle of wine. It was great. We went back to the thing. Okay. So this is about when I started to really descend into agoraphobia. It's not going to be that long. It's about pee. I know that's weird. We're going to get through it together because we're a community. When I was 21, I got into the habit of voiding my bladder into chamber pots of my own invention. I was afraid to use the bathroom because I'd had one too many panic attacks there. I wasn't a religious person, but I was into the kind of hippie spirituality sold in the New Age section at mainstream bookstores. Therefore, I diagnosed my bathroom with a case of seriously bad vibes and devised a far more soul-nurturing habit of pissing in my bedroom in dinnerware. They were actually a very nice set of plain white bowls from the outlet back home in Flemington, New Jersey, where I grew up. My mother had bought them for me as a housewarming gift when I moved into that apartment. The bathroom, a feat of space maximization, was the size of an airplane lavatory with a very slender shower stall tacked on. When I sat down to pee, back when I still used the toilet, my knees bumped the door. It was impossible to have sex in that shower, a fact I confirmed more than once through trial and error. You just keep doing the same thing and it doesn't work out, but you expect it was awkward. Bathrooms, regardless of size, had always been my place of refuge from the fits of terror that stalked me throughout late childhood and adolescence. I developed rituals to stave off the attacks. I sang the same old church hymn, "Be Not Afraid," under my breath over and over again. I rocked back and forth, holding myself. I hit myself in the face to shake my brain loose. Not hard, I used a totally normal level of force like you do when you hit yourself in the face. When things got really bad, I'd lean my head on the wall or even on the roll of toilet paper itself and cry. No one bothers you in the bathroom because only pervs try to engage with other people in the bathroom. My friend, the actor James Urbaniak, who voices, it was 2012, Dr. Venture on the Adult Swim hit Venture Brothers. He's also on Difficult People, wonderful show. Okay, once played a toilet freak on an episode of Law & Order SVU. That's the rapey one, not the courtroomy one or the other one. His character installed a secret camera in a bathroom so that he could watch ladies go to the toilet. After the inevitable lurid sexual assault that occurs on every episode of SVU, the cops find the camera and they trace it to James's character. They burst into his apartment where his sister, played by the wonderful Amy Sedaris, is trying to hide him. Anyway, turns out the toilet freak isn't the one who committed the violent sex crime. We don't find this out before Christopher Maloney hauls him downtown and slams his no-good pervy ass up against the bars. James told me that Maloney pushed him so hard that the bars, which are made of plywood, actually bent and had to be replaced on set. Just really into it. I remember watching this episode a few years after I'd had my own fit of freaky toilet behavior and feeling a strange sort of kinship with the voyeur character. I didn't get a sexual thrill from watching other people use the bathroom, unlike our president, but I did share his view of the restroom. It's in there in 2012, can you believe it? It was offensive. I did share his view of the restroom as a special place set apart from less exciting rooms like the living room or the dining room. These rooms were prosaic and uninspired places where one was expected to make small talk with any number of irritating companions. But in the bathroom, even if another person sat not 6 inches from you in a neighboring stall, you were blessedly alone. So you can imagine my irritation when I discovered I wasn't alone in my tiny bathroom in that cramped studio apartment in Boston. I'd moved into the place in May, and as the months passed, I gradually became aware that something was following me wherever I went, sitting on my shoulder or atop my head. I didn't know what it was, but it was a bad something, and sometimes it would get very loud. My solution was to keep my life noisy, filled with chatter and bustle. I had just finished my sophomore year at Emerson College, a school for writers and actors and people who didn't get into NYU. It was a colorful, loud, silly place. In the hall between classes, somebody was always singing or dancing, and it was very fancy, kind of upscale, like intelligent, weird thing, and I wasn't familiar with it. And I didn't fit in. I had long, curly brown hair and big boobs, imagine, and a belly I was still convinced was pudgy 3 years after Amber Luciano had made a crack about my weight on an ill-fated school trip to Sicily. It's earlier. It's wonderful. One, like, deftly rendered, funny yet poignant. At the end, you're like, how did she survive? It's amazing. You should buy the book. Okay. So I made friends, and the friends were, they were cool, they were different. They did cocaine and wore really tight diesel jeans and dabbled in the kind of stand-up comedy where you made a joke about a children's show people remembered from like the 70s or 80s, and then the audience laughed, and then you looked at the audience like you hated them. And then you made fun of a band you secretly liked, and then you rolled your eyes and got off stage and drank whiskey. This was called alternative comedy. And it was very cool. There were a lot of alternative comics out in Los Angeles, and that was where everyone was going to move once they finished school. I couldn't imagine moving to LA. I couldn't imagine standing on a stage by myself and telling jokes to strangers. Instead, I went to the other kids' shows and then went home and wrote poetry about feelings and cups of tea. I had a lot of both of those in college. I didn't write about the panic attacks because in writing class, everybody got to read everyone else's poems, and I didn't want any of these skinny, pretty people with frayed on-purpose clothing to know that I was the wrong kind of different. I got a job as a receptionist in a hair salon that summer. It was called Très Bien, which in French means angry queen. And in between the stylist temper tantrums, I managed to enjoy myself. During one inspired lecture, during a weekly staff meeting, the co-owner, Bruce, stared intently at each of us in turn while growling, "There's a lot of bad hair out there, and some of it comes from other salons on Newbury Street." Then he threw a bottle of bedhead shampoo across the room and yelled, "But not from this salon!" The stylist, some of them actually drank during the breaks. The money from the hair salon funded some of my purchases at my favorite shops, the bookshops, and this little trinkets at this shop where this guy with long hair sold books and crystals with berries painted on things and weird goth skull and bones candlestick holders. It was great. For a short while that summer, I had a therapist named Mabia or Mons or something vulvic. I don't quite remember, but it was like very adjacent. Her name was fun to speak in conversations with friends, but the woman herself was not particularly entertaining. I didn't go to see her often because she let too many quiet moments creep into our sessions, and going to see her didn't really seem to do anything. And I'd figured out a few secrets to staving off panic attacks on my own: urinating 3 times before leaving the house, murmuring a prayer I'd found in a book, and carrying a small pebble I'd found on the shore of one of the tiny islands in Boston Harbor where I'd choked on a French fry and been administered the Heimlich maneuver by a stranger. I don't know when things began to curdle and spoil inside me that year. Certainly the ingredients had been present since childhood, but it's hard to say what finally flipped my switch. It's tempting to blame it on September 11th, 2001, but that's too pat and also quite stupid. I lost no friend or family member on that day. It was sad and it was frightening, but it also provided an excuse for me to stand in line for 3 hours with the boy I secretly loved, chatting glumly while we waited to donate blood at Mass General. Once the initial shock of the news wore off, I found myself wondering if it was true that tragedy brought people together, and more specifically, if I could get him to tearfully make out with me that night. Anyway, it turned out he couldn't donate blood because he'd done coke too recently, but we still got to spend the afternoon together. So it wasn't September 11th that did it, and it wasn't the invasion of Afghanistan, and it wasn't the release of Destiny's Child's blockbuster sophomore outing Survivor, which followed the writings on, well, what, it's a long story. Anyway. DC3, which was completely awesome and probably delayed my descent into madness. I still didn't know what it was sitting on my shoulder, just that it was. And so in the latter half of 2001, I enjoyed an extended spell of what the Victorians might have politely called hysteria. All right, that's it. Ah, hello.
Hello, Sarah Benincasa.
Hi. Hello.
See that red
there you
book.
Go.
You left, what a cliffhanger. Right as you descended to hysteria, mm-hmm. She leaves the podium.
I said, leave him wanting more.
Yeah. This is beautiful. Look at this beautiful book. Wow, thanks for being here. I have so many questions for you, even more now, but we...
I know I ran long, I'm sorry.
No, it's okay. We need to have like a slumber party or something.
No, we can hang out.
Let's
like, do that.
I have a lot to talk to you about.
Well, let's talk.
But right now... I want to tell you that for you guys who are on Twitter, Sarah has a mighty Twitter presence and it's actually been really helping me out lately.
Oh,
and so, yeah. So thank you for being there. And I'm wondering, does it help you to have such, like, what's your relationship like with the internet? Does it help you to have such a strong presence, or does it ever like bite you in the butt?
I actually made a big change late last year with it, and specifically into this year where I use it less. I still use it a lot, but in terms of social media. But I got rid of my private Facebook, which is great. because I didn't have to pretend to like care about people who voted for Donald Trump, who I know. I could just sort of be like, oh no, I never liked you in high school. Like, I don't care what your kids look like, delete. So I just have a front-facing author comedian page, and I use that a few times a day. I definitely tweet sometimes, but less than I used to. Mm-hmm. It's brought me a lot of good things. It's also brought bad things. You know, it's sort of like you meet somebody cute and you get like a death threat. Like, a little of this, a little of that.
It's like everything the world has to offer packed into one day, the highs and the lows.
Yeah. I mean, I learned about reporting threats against public officials to the FBI. And I also went on some cool dates.
Cool.
You know, it's great. I'm not on Tinder, and my mom is really into the idea of me doing that.
Tinder? Your mom?
Yeah, she found out what Tinder is, which I don't know why she was permitted to know. But someone told her that. But I don't know. It's been good. Like, do you find it stressful? I had to cut back.
You know, a friend of mine who's very wise says to me, crazy meets crazy where crazy's at. Mm-hmm. And I think about that when I'm engaging in a Twitter war with somebody named Chilbro Swaggins.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And I'm like responding to this person for like the seventh time. I'm like not letting it go. I'm like, oh, you think that? I get a response for you. And then I'm just like, I'm crazy. And then I need to step away from my phone for a little while.
I block a lot. I mute more because sometimes when you block people, that inflames them because it gives them a sense of importance. And so I'll mute more, which is good. I did have my most popular tweet ever yesterday. Do you want to know what it is?
Congratulations, yeah.
Thank you. It's great. It's been liked like 13,000 times. Here's what it is. Not political, nothing. My friend has a dog named Oscar who I used to live with in New York City many years ago. We've kept up. And Oscar turned 13, so she dressed him up and put him in a yarmulke and sent me a picture of him and said, it's his bar mitzvah. And I said, this is such a cute photograph of your 13-year-old dog, who I now know, because it's been pointed out 50 times, looks like Wolf Blitzer. I know that now. I didn't know before. The internet told me. I said, can I put this on Twitter? I think it's really cute. People lost their minds with joy because we're in such a place where a lot of us are so stressed and scared.
Yeah.
And so to see someone just having fun and making their dog just a man, it's so goofy and delightful that people laughed and loved it.
Yeah.
So it was great.
People need little bursts of humor right now, mm-hmm. in between everyone's like so addicted to their phones and the bad news and everything.
And silliness specifically.
Yeah.
Like silly happiness with a cute dog.
Yeah.
It's a good thing.
Something like that. I'm very curious as to what you're working on right now. Like, where is your creative focus? And is it hard to stay focused with everything that's happening?
Yeah. What I'm working on now is, my third book is two are nonfiction and two are fiction. And, my second novel is called DC Trip. And so I'm adapting it right now as a screenplay. And so with my producers, we were like pretty done with, you know, we had gone through, you know, the contracted drafts and everything, and we were pretty ready to give it to people. To see what they thought and if they wanted to be in it and stuff. And that's the technical term, right? Hollywood. do you want to be in this, Tom Cruise? But then it's called DC Trip. It's about kids who from Jersey who go on a school trip to Washington, D.C.
Yes.
And, you know, in the third act or a later chapter in book talk, they meet an individual with a certain amount of power. So that was one individual in the book, not named, but you know, you could figure it out pretty easy. And then in the screenplay was somebody else. And then somebody else who we didn't expect to be that person in real life became the person. And we're like, what the fuck do we do with this? What do we do with this? Do we pretend? At first I was like, whatever, let's go with like our alternate reality. Now it's alternate reality. It's Earth 2. It's set on Earth 2. Gay people are happy and immigrants are beloved by all. It's fine. And my producers were like, okay, or we could engage with reality and like art talking about what's really happening is like kind of important. I was like, shut up. All right. So I'm I'm doing a, you know, I got a paycheck out of it. Thanks, Donald Trump. I got hired to rewrite my shit. So thanks, buddy. So that's what I'm doing right now.
That's really exciting. Do you find that kind of structure do you take to that? Do you get how to write screenplay structure, scripty stuff? Because it's different than writing just like your story or a book.
I had to read a bunch of them before I felt comfortable. I mean, I'd never, before I adapted Agoraphobulous as a pilot for a couple networks, and I had never opened Final Draft, which is the software that a lot of people use. And I'd never opened it. I didn't know what to do. I sort of like schemed my way into getting a job, and then I had to learn how to do the job.
Yeah.
So this is the first screenplay I've ever written. I've never written a full length, motion picture. Uh-huh. I'd done a short film called The Focus Group that I was in that came out last year, but about a woman who is insecure, so she focus groups her body and her sort of brand, her personal brand. And that was fun, but that's, 10 pages? This is different. I mean, it's weird. The structure, story is story, but the structure is different.
It's very specific.
I was overwhelmed. I procrastinated starting, and finally one of my producers was like, what's getting in the way? And I was like, what if I get the format wrong? And he was like, that's just not the right answer. What's really going on? I was like, I'm scared. And he was like, just maybe do it. And I was like, that's fine. You're right. I need to make money. but it's been wonderful. It forces you, I think, as opposed to writing a book, writing a script, it forces economy of language.
Mm-hmm.
And there's so much show, don't tell, because that's the whole fucking point.
Yeah.
And so it's been interesting. It feels like learning how to do my job all over again every time. Every time there's a new format, you know? Do you ever feel that way when you try to tackle a new format?
Yeah, or even just write another book. I'm like, how come I don't know how to do this yet? I've done it before.
Do you always forget about the point where you want to kill yourself while writing the book? Do you want to kill yourself when you write books? Because I do every time.
I wouldn't say it's that, but it's definitely 50 pages in, I'm soaring, and then I'm like, what was I thinking? This is the wrong project. The other book was the right project. And I had a period in my life where I started three different books. I got 50 pages in. I was like, wait, I'm catching on to a pattern here.
So, what does this mean about me?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that we all, as writers, oftentimes, when I talk to authors, I find everybody has to, some people have to trick themselves into doing work and sitting down. And some people are more stick people. They need to be punished in some way if they don't do the work. And some people are carrot people. And I am a carrot person. So I have to set a goal. And then, then I'll tell a friend, we can go to the mall, Jersey. Literally one time I was like, I have to finish the second act. And only then can we go to Cheesecake Factory. And she was like, do we have to at all? And I was like, yes! you're keeping me accountable. She was like, we could go to a good restaurant. I was like, shut up.
I like stick and carrot. We're going to find out what our next author, if she is a stick writer or a carrot writer. Yes. And this is Shanti Sekaran, who just wrote the beautiful new book, Lucky Boy. She's on a little Southern California book tour. We're so psyched that we are one of her stops here. She's also the author of the novel, The Prayer Room. So please welcome Shanti Sekaran. Thanks, Sarah.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for coming out tonight. I don't know how I'm going to follow you. You're funny and pithy.
But your hair looks amazing, and your lipstick is on fire, and you're very smart.
All right. Okay, well then. So I wrote this book called Lucky Boy, and it's just come out in January. And it tells a story of a young, undocumented woman who crosses the border from Mexico and ends up in Berkeley, California. And when she's there, she has a baby, and then she gets eventually put into a detention center. She's picked up and put in detention, and her young son goes to foster parents. So I also tell the story of the foster parents who've been trying to have children and end up taking in this little boy and really falling in love with him and kind of wanting to keep him. So that's where the dilemma of the book rises from. So what I have here is just a little section about Soli. Soli is our Mexican protagonist. She's about 18 years old. She's just made it over the border. I won't talk much about her journey. It wasn't pretty. It wasn't what it was supposed to be. But she makes it, and she ends up in Berkeley, and she is finding her cousin, Sylvia. Now, Sylvia is, she's pretty well established in Berkeley. She has a business. She hires out cleaning ladies. She has a life. She has an apartment. She has two sons. and she welcomes Soli to her home. And that's where we begin. Arriving in Berkeley, she exited the station and stood on the corner of a wide and teeming avenue. This could have been any corner anywhere. Garbage cans overflowed, and the place smelled of rot. In the thick and stormy air, there was nowhere for the stench to go. This is America, she thought. As she approached, she could see that Sylvia's building leaned slightly at an angle. A label with a tiny doorbell, Morales. Soli rang it. She heard the thump of heavy footsteps. The door opened. Sylvia. Sylvia stood tall as a statue, so clean, so American. Soli stepped over the threshold and into Sylvia's arms. She held her so long that Soli stopped feeling both her cousin's body and her own. Her legs gave out, and she began to cry, not from sorrow or anger, but from wild exhaustion, the only thing she still owned. "You smell like shit," Sylvia said. "Where have you been?" "I've been getting here." "Come upstairs, girl. What did you do to your hair? Your puppy's been calling every day. You've made him crazy. Why haven't you called him?" Upstairs, two boys waited, Sylvia's sons, 5 and 7. Before she could kneel down and smile or take them in her arms or ask them what they liked to eat, Sylvia shoved a towel in her face and pointed to the bathroom. "Shower," she ordered. This was Soli's first shower. In Popocalco, they'd had baths and only baths. She would come to miss baths, of course, but that morning, the shower was what she needed. The steam kept her warm, and the past sped down the drain. She was an earthworm in the warm spring rain. Now that she had arrived, her happiness had time to establish its landscape, and it was not pure. Her happiness was terrain pitted with melancholy. The end of her journey brought with it the realization that Santa Clara Popocalco was behind her, perhaps forever, and that she would never again be the Soli she'd once known so intimately. Sylvia walked in while she was drying off. "That's better. Now I can see you." She picked up the soccer players do it for 90 minutes shirt and scowled. "I'll burn this," she said. "No, I want to keep it." Soli snatched it from her. The shirt hung heavy with filth, and she let it drop to the floor again. She would wash away the stink and sweat and fear. It would be clean again, like Soli. Sylvia found Soli a skirt and a t-shirt. The shirt was fine, but the skirt slid to the floor as soon as it was on. "You're too skinny," Sylvia said. "You'll do good here, all right. Skinny here means you're smart and hardworking. And rich." They laughed together. Sylvia found her a cotton dress with no sleeves. "This'll do," she said. "I used to wear this before the boys were born. If this falls off you, we're both in trouble." Soli took off her shirt and reached for the dress, but Sylvia held it. Soli's hair dripped down her back, and she winced. Sylvia let her stand there, naked as a worm, and stared. "The dress, please, Sylvia." Sylvia's eyes cupped each portion of Soli, her breasts, her stomach. They rested on the two purple bruises that spread over Soli's hips. She sucked her breath in. "It's nothing," Soli said. Her eyes settled on Soli's face, and she gasped. "What?" "You're having a baby." "Stop it. Dress, come on." Sylvia shook her head. "You're pregnant." And because Sylvia was Sylvia and never wrong, Soli looked down at her belly as if searching for a stain she hadn't noticed. She saw the puff of hair below her waist, her small, sure abdomen, and her breasts, on most days as pointless as two unborn mice. Now they seemed to be on the verge of waking. "Whose baby is this?" She felt no different. She couldn't be pregnant. And yet, the possibilities whirled and settled. "Checo," Soli said. "It could only be Checo." "Who the hell is Checo?" The answer felt foolish, so she said nothing. "Soli, Soli, Soli." Sylvia came closer. Soli saw something alive on her cousin's face that she identified as emotion. She hadn't seen emotion in days. She mistook it for love.
"Idiota!" Sylvia slapped her across the face. "Pinche puta!
What were you thinking? This is how you come to America? This is your big plan? Sylvia whipped the dress at her. The cotton caught her waist and stung. Sylvia, stop it, I'm sorry. You're sorry? Stupid, stupid Soli. This is not what your papi spent all his money for. Danielle and Aldo stood in the doorway. They'd probably never seen their mother whipping a naked relative. Sylvia shooed them away. Get dressed, she muttered, and slammed the door. When Soli came out again, Sylvia was in the kitchen, pulling something from the oven. Sit down, food's ready. Sylvia spooned rice and chicken onto her plate, and when she plopped down an extra serving of meat, Soli felt like maybe things would be okay. Her cousin tipped the boy's uneaten rice onto her own plate and sat down to eat. She hunched over her food in the old familiar way, smacking her thick lips and frowning. Soli, for a moment, could have been back in Popocalco, in an old adobe hut with Sylvia and her family. While they ate, the kitchen grew warm and her troubles cool. Sylvia looked up once in the old Sylvia way. Then she paused, put her fork down, and picked up her napkin. We don't even know, she said, still chewing. Have you done a test? Soli shook her head. So, we don't even know. Maybe I'm wrong. But Soli knew Sylvia, and Sylvia was never wrong. Thank you.
Oh, let me see this giant, beautiful book. Lucky boy. Clap again for that beautiful passage, Shanti Sekaran. Congratulations.
Thanks.
Man, what a feat. It must feel... Okay, so when did you start working on this book?
I started thinking about this book in 2010 and working on it in 2011.
Okay.
So it's been a while.
Do you know where the germ of the idea came from?
Yeah, for the story? Very specifically, it came from a news report that I heard on NPR, which is why everyone should donate to NPR. So I heard about a Guatemalan woman who was fighting for custody of her own child, who was being adopted away from her because she had been picked up and put in detention and was being deported. So I really just, I listened to the story and I couldn't stop thinking about it. And I wanted to know, you know, the stuff they don't tell you in a news report. Like, yeah. What's this person thinking? What's that person thinking?
What sort of research did you have to engage in to kind of...
All kinds.
Yeah.
All kinds. So I started off just learning about the situation of undocumented immigration. I watched lots of documentaries. I learned about how people make their way up through Mexico, riding on the top of freight trains, which is very dangerous. I talked to adoptive parents. I spoke to foster parents. I went to Mexico for 2 weeks. I spent an afternoon at Google. I spent an afternoon in a sorority kitchen. There were just all kinds of opportunities for research here.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
It must feel really surreal having started this years ago and now it's out and now mm-hmm. we are in this climate, this anti-immigration climate
yeah.
that is so
God.
Overwhelming
yeah.
and more horrible than ever.
Mm-hmm.
What has it been like mm-hmm. for you bringing the book around?
It's been, you know, so far I've mostly been in audiences, I've been in audiences that have been very sympathetic to the plight of undocumented immigrants. So I haven't really had to deal with anyone yet who's been, you know, very contentious or really just wanted to stand up and give me a lecture about, you know, why undocumented immigrants are bad or what have you.
Right.
I've been in a bit of a bubble, but I couldn't have imagined that we'd be in this situation. I mean, I knew it was an issue in 2011.
Sure.
I didn't imagine this.
It would get so escalated.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I mean, I feel like... Never mind any kind of like people with bad attitudes reading it. It's such a story that anyone, I feel like there's just a lot of like, even like privileged non-immigrant and white people mm-hmm. who are thinking much more hard about issues that people think about maybe all the time. And I just think that mm-hmm. this is a great book.
Yeah.
You know, I just
yeah.
feel like people, I think a lot of people are waking up, you know, just even, did you go to the Women's March?
Yeah.
Yeah. Did you go in Berkeley?
I went in Oakland.
In Oakland? How was it?
It was huge.
Yeah.
It was huge and very family oriented.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of the, like we took BART, which is the regional, you know, the subway in the Bay Area. and there were just like lines snaking around the North Berkeley BART station, just like parents and children. And, you know, in a way, I think that's wonderful. I think it's really important that we involve our kids. I also wonder if there was a certain amount of, you know, I don't know. I'm sort of torn about the idea of taking one's kids and making it sort of a family picnic day when really we're really fighting something that is quite scary.
Yeah. There's just, I've seen so many articles about people how like it's the first protest for so many people. There's so many people who haven't necessarily fought for things.
Right.
And, who are looking, I think, for ways to hopefully just stay awake and stay engaged. And I just want to like throw your book at all
and
of
I,
them.
And I guess it, sure. And I guess it, is important for people to go to protests and realize that they're not always violent. You know, we're not always setting things on fire.
Only when we absolutely
sometimes
have to.
Only at Berkeley.
Yeah. Only when it's absolutely necessary.
Only,
it sometimes is, as
like
we learned.
Yeah.
I know you must feel very proud to be from Berkeley right now.
I am. Yeah. I was really, you know, I mean, you do not send Milo to Berkeley. That's just,
I mean, what was anyone thinking about that?
I don't know.
How, you have two children.
Mm-hmm.
You have two little boys, 3 and 9?
Uh-huh, almost 9.
Yeah. How are you talking to them? Are you talking to them about what's happening in the world right now?
My 9-year-old, he's pretty clued in. He listens, he actually likes listening to NPR. Mm-hmm. He doesn't talk about it. I think he's getting a sense of sort of the depth of what's going on, mm-hmm. which is scary for kids because they don't know where it ends, you know, they don't know how deep it goes. So I don't really speak to him much about it. I was telling you earlier that he just thinks of Trump as like a big buffoon. And Trump for him is sort of a clown-like figure. I sort of haven't really talked to him about it because I don't want to scare him. I don't want to make him feel like, oh, maybe I should be worrying.
Right. You have to preserve their innocence while like also sort of like keeping them plugged into reality in an appropriate way.
Until it's they have tricky. A way to process it with some perspective.
Yeah.
You know, then they can get scared.
Yeah. Are you a carrot writer or are you a stick writer?
I think I'm a carrot writer.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or maybe it's both. Maybe if someone chased me with both, I'd run.
Being whacked with a stick towards a carrot.
I mean,
that's how
metaphor. The carrot was this idea of publishing something that at the time felt very relevant and now feels even more. And because I don't usually do that. I mean, if you read my other stuff, it's about like dogs in space and Heathcliff eating pancakes. And so that was the carrot, that idea of being really relevant and being really excited about the project. And then the stick was this very writerly selfish idea of like, oh my God, what if someone else writes this book before me? Which I think, you know, we do that. I was checking the Sunday Times every week to see if someone else had in fact
what would you have
book.
Done?
Probably just kept writing the book. And in fact, I found out that, you know, in the meantime, there were like 4 other books with similar themes, not of course the exact same story, similar themes that happened to come out and I just didn't notice and I just kept writing
my
book.
I'm glad you didn't notice. You don't need that in your mind.
Exactly.
Because it's like your story is never going to look like another story.
Sure.
I could sit down with the same sort of premise and come up, you know what I mean, with some spindly little anemic version of your beautiful book. You know what I mean? It's like you can only tell your story like in your voice.
Yeah.
So that's... It's very exciting. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Where are you next around here? So maybe some of these folks can tell their people.
Tomorrow I'm going to be at Roman's in Pasadena at 7. That's exciting.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'm going to be in Santa Barbara at the Santa Barbara Winery on Saturday. And then Monday I'm doing this lunch thing. It's like a ladies' lunch. It's called Ladies' Lunch in Literacy. that's through Mysterious Galaxy Books in Redondo Beach. So
cool.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Thanks,
go
Michelle.
See Shanti and her other stops in Southern California.
Thank you.
We have one final writer who's also a visual artist. She's a graphic novelist. Her name is Mari Naomi, and she's the author of the books Kiss and Tell, Dragon's Breath, Turning Japanese, and she has another project, which she's created our Cartoonist of Color database. So we'll talk to her about all that stuff after we get to peek at her life.
Please welcome Mari Naomi.
Hello. So I'm going to read from this book, Dragon's Breath and Other True Stories. It came out in 2014. I feel like this, it's a collection of short comic essays. They're all memoir. And I thought that this story was pretty tension building, so that's why I chose it. And I have a very short comic afterwards. So Dragon's Breath and Other True Stories. This story is called A Stranger's House. Thanks for offering to come with me. I don't know what I was thinking going alone. You know, it's not just that you're going to some stranger's house to take nude photos, it's that he calls himself Daddy Bill. Actually, it's Papa Bob. Whatever. Where'd you meet this guy again? On Tribe, in your art whore tribe, in fact. I think this is it. This doesn't look too scary.
Oh, hello, you're right on time. I'm Robert. But you can call me Papa Bob. My studio is downstairs. I bought this place with my first wife after I got back from NAMM.
I used to do work as an artist model.
Is that right? Do you want to use props?
Yes. I brought some scarves.
Ka-chee! How's the temperature?
Nice and warm.
Ka-chee! Let's take a break while I switch lenses.
Hey, how's it going? Fine, this is really fun. Would you mind if I wait upstairs for you? It's so warm here.
Of course not. Are you sure?
Yes, I feel safe here.
Ready? Just lift your head up and...
Like this?
Perfect.
Ka-chee!
Now tilt your...
Ka-chee!
So tell me about your...
How long have you been?
Lower your arm. Just... And when I got back, my PTSD was so bad. I didn't know where I was. I just knew they were out to kill me. Every morning I woke up with my hands clenched around my wife's neck. She'd scream for me to wake up. Guys, I gotta get going soon.
Okay, I think we're almost done. Thanks, that was a lot of fun.
It was my pleasure. You know, if you'd like to stick around to review some of the photos, I could give you a ride home after.
Really? Well, if it's not too much trouble.
Hey,
are you sure you want to stay here?
I'd like to see those photos.
Okay.
That there's Richard M. Nixon, the greatest president that ever lived.
Okay, well, call me when you get home, okay? I will.
That's the end of that story.
Thanks. I have a really short one that appeared in this paper that came out as an answer to the elections called Resist. And I made this comic for it. Matter of time. How many of you don't want me here? Maybe I should get out while I can. What was the point of no return for the victims of the Holocaust? It's just a matter of time.
go back to your country. This is my country. Thanks.
Hi, Mari Naomi.
Hi, Michelle T.
Look at these great things. She comes up with all her papers. Her beautiful book, Dragon's Breath. I wish that we could all get this.
They made 60,000 copies of that, which is, and handed them out at the Women's March and inauguration. And
the one in D.C. specifically? Or
everywhere, actually. They were in Portland, here.
Goodness.
I got to the march this year too late, or maybe there were just too many people, but I didn't see it there. So I just got my contributor's copy.
I'm so jealous. Some terrible person will be auctioning it off on eBay for like $500. Watch.
Wow. 60,000 copies. It's being used for toilet paper right now.
No,
I'm sure.
No, it's so wonderful. I'm happy I get to touch it. How are you taking care of yourself in this horrible climate right now?
I'm drinking a lot.
Okay. Tried and true method of stress relief.
More than I should probably. Yeah, I feel like ever since Election Day, what else? Oh, I've been listening to a lot of serial killer podcasts. I don't know why. In fact, the other day I was listening to a last podcast on the left, and they mentioned you, and I got very excited.
I bought my friend a necklace made of human teeth, and he's one of the hosts.
That's
it's fine.
Amazing.
You'll love it.
I have cufflinks made of human teeth.
I love this. They hate it, but I love it.
Yeah, that's my self-care regime, whiskey and serial killers.
Okay. I can see how that would work for
it
sure.
It takes the edge off.
Yeah, yeah. It could always be worse or something, maybe.
Well, it's so unreal. I feel like, I mean, oh gosh, maybe I'm dooming myself by saying this, but serial killers just seem like, well, it's just so over the top that that can't be a reality, right?
I was like you on election night. I did. I thought everything was really funny. I'd made a Trumpkin. So I'd made this. I carved a pumpkin to look like Trump with like a big chunk of pumpkin head hair.
Oh,
and then I made
beautiful.
Guacamole kind of barfing out of his mouth. You know, I thought it was really funny. But then I was
really
like crying,
funny.
Eating like brown guacamole
oh.
at like midnight. You know,
out of his mouth, really. I have a vision.
More or less, more or
Let's
less.
Let's move on. Yeah.
Do you feel that anxiety propels you to create work, or do you feel like it impedes creativity?
It's completely stopped me up. I've definitely felt plugged. In fact, I mean, most of my comics, like the first one I just read, I usually wait a long time before I write about it so that I can have more of a perspective on things, because in the moment when something traumatic like that, she lived, by the way, although apparently it got really freaky once I left.
It did.
Yeah, no, he brought, I don't know, this is being taped. Anyway, I'll tell you later.
Okay.
But it wasn't
she's
good,
okay.
But she's okay now, a little traumatized, but not, you know, not too bad. She won't be doing that again, though. but so I like to have a lot of space to get perspective. And so when this all started happening, I've just been depressed and horrified. And this is really the only piece of art that I've managed to make. I've been doing other things. Like I edited I helped edit an online anthology for PEN America called State of Emergency, where we three of us got a bunch of different cartoonists to write about things that I apparently have a hard time writing about right now. I don't know, this just flowed out of me in a matter of seconds. I did it on Post-it notes. I'm like, I have to do something for this resist paper.
On Post-it notes?
Well, originally. Originally it was maybe I showed my husband Gary. I'm like, well, this is what it originally was. And it was like 25 Post-it notes it was all over the place. But I basically just took this best six and put them together, because I have so much to say. But then, yeah, as soon as I said those six panels, and I've not been able to say anymore, sucks. But I figure in 10 years I'll be able to write about it if I'm still, you know, not blown up by a nuclear. Anyway, sorry.
No, the work will be here, and you will produce before 10 years. Like we're all in a state of shock, and we're all gonna acclimate in our different ways and be able to make work. That's what I think.
I'm still making fluffy, stupid work that has nothing to do with anything.
Good. Will you talk about the work that you do creating the Cartoonist of Color database?
That's one way. Whenever I feel like I'm maybe not doing enough, because I don't know, I always feel like I'm not doing enough, but then I like, okay, I'm doing some things, and that's one of the things that I could keep going back to, is I have this database of, well, there are two databases. One's called The Cartoonist of Color, and the other one's called Queer Cartoonists, and it's just a list of people's names, their websites, and maybe a little drawing of theirs, and they're just all cartoonists who fit that category. In the cartoonists of color, there's actually several categories. One are queer cartoonists of color, one are non-male, and maybe that's just the main list also. So yeah, every week or so I update it and spend a few hours doing that, and then I'll try to find, like, I have, There's almost 1,000 people in this database, the Cartoonists of Color, and I'll every time I send out a tweet or something saying, oh, I've updated the database, I'll always go through the database and find someone to highlight and have their picture go up. I don't know. It makes me feel like I'm doing something.
You are doing something. That's really exciting.
Thanks.
Yeah, it sounds fun, too.
It's all right. Like it's not really fun. It is, that part is fun, but it really is just data entry. And then hearing a lot of, like, people who aren't in the databases criticize my databases. I mean, that's not fun.
that is the nerdiest criticism ever. Like, no. Someone's going to criticize your database. Like, you should just be like, enjoy yourself. Have at it, nerd.
I blocked two people, not about the databases, but I blocked two people on Facebook today. And I when Sarah was talking about cutting back, that, especially after today, sounds really nice.
It's empowering to block people.
It does feel kind
of
good.
It's like all of the people from my hometown that were still hanging on, they're gone now. I'm free. I'm finally free. I want to open it up to you guys. I bet you have questions for these smart people. I'd like for you to keep it to questions, not comments. Hopefully you've come with a friend and you can share your comments with your friend afterwards over some fries or a piece of pie. But let's keep it with questions here so we can keep conversation engaged and keep the focus on these folks. What do you say?
I've got one right up here.
Okay.
It's a question. How do each of you, if you don't mind going one at a time, and you can decide who goes first, how do you manage anxiety of your creation when you are creating? What are your tricks, your tips? How do you deal?
Help us out, people. That's why we brought you here.
Obviously I was very jokey and performative, but I when I was up here, but I have very severe agoraphobia. I have something, a few different things, but panic attacks and depression, which at times in my life has been suicidal. And if I'm going to pick any of those, I'll pick the anxiety stuff because it's active, right? You know, suicidal depression is just like, you know, you definitely want to die. When I'm anxious, I want to live and I want to create. I want to do art. I just am terrified to leave the house. So if that's what I'm dealing with, a lot of breathing exercises, for sure. I did a program when I was younger it was designed by Jon Kabat-Zinn at the University of Massachusetts Medical Center at Worcester, called Mindfulness-Based Stress Reduction. So a lot of that is helpful. Those tips and tricks, feeling things in different parts of your body. I've had a lot of cognitive behavioral therapy. So some of it I learned in therapy. The basic thing that I can say, if you're just anxious and it's really not a clinical thing or probably you're just scared about writing or worried you won't be good enough, is give yourself permission to take breaks. Get up, walk away, sit back down. And what I always keep in mind is I think about what my potential, I stole this from the Moth website. What's my potential last line? And I'll think about that. And then I'll try to work towards that so that I'm not seizing up at the fear of the first line. So that's what I do. Xanax is cool sometimes.
I get very anxious about the idea of having to produce a product. There's a lot of pressure around having to produce, like, an article that's going to go here or is going to go to this contest. So I try not to hold myself too much to creating, like, you know, product A or product B, especially when I get into zones where I'm just not feeling like writing. So at those points, I stick more to just exercises that are probably never going to go anywhere. Like, I give myself permission to be completely unproductive while producing, or completely, you know, not goal-oriented. I think when you start to become a published writer, you start to become very goal-oriented. Like, where is this going to go? how am I going to maximize the potential of this output or whatever. That sounded very non-writerly, but that's sort of how we think sometimes. Mm-hmm. So I give myself permission to just like screw around a bit. And I try to walk. I don't really take many medications. I try to walk a lot and just give myself permission to do what I need to do.
Serial killer podcast.
Last podcast on the left.
My favorite murder is another one. Actually, there's like five of them that I'm rotating around. So sometimes those actually make me anxious. I don't know why. So I'll switch to the Dear Sugar podcast, which is the polar opposite. It's just all compassion and sweet hurt feelings. But to be honest, when I'm working, I don't, especially if I'm writing or plotting, like really using my brain, that takes a lot of the anxiety away. Sometimes when I'm drawing, that's when I listen to the podcast, because that's when my brain starts doing this thing. But I've also started going to Korean spas lately, which that is one of my, I had two New Year's resolutions. One is to learn a song on the ukulele. I haven't practiced for a while now. It's February, shit. And the other one is to go to the spa at least once a month.
That's awesome.
That is really great.
I highly recommend.
You both talked about doing something that takes you out of your head and into your body more, walking mm-hmm. and going to the spa.
It helps me write, too, especially if I'm sitting in the spa. Like, there's nothing for me to do with my hands. There's no serial killers in my head, and I'm not drinking whiskey, so my brain is able to do that thing that it does when you're driving, where it just kind of zones out. And that, I come up with a lot of epiphanies for things that I'm stuck with in my art when I'm doing that.
That's cool.
Which is cool.
I take 30 milligrams of citalopram, and I can't give it enough thumbs up. I don't have enough thumbs on my body.
Thanks. You guys, we talked at various points about just feeling stuck, and I'm wondering, especially for those of you who've ever been in periods of non-productivity, where you're not sure if there's going to be another book, or you know, you're not sure because of, say, current events, like, should I keep creating at all, you know? So how do you deal with not so much like I'm in the middle of a book and I can't finish it, but like, should I keep writing at all?
I read, I'm going to say it wrong, Desiderata by Max Ehrman, which is like, you matter. And I'm like, oh, thank you. And then I weep.
What is this book, Sarah?
You know the poem? It's really famous. You see it all the time. It's by Max Ehrman. It's called Desiderata. Okay. And it's like, you too are a child of God. Mm-hmm. So I only read things about God, which I'm actually here to talk to you all tonight about Jesus Christ and how you could bring him into your life. So I read something that's inspiring that reminds me that I matter no matter what I do or don't produce. And I go to therapy. I go to Al-Anon. I eat donuts at Al-Anon. It's the only reason I go. I get myself around people who have other priorities besides whether or not I create a thing, and who like me or hate me or don't care about me regardless. It helps me get out of my own head and realize, like, at the end of the day, like, if I don't write another book, that's okay. I want to, but I still led a worthwhile life. I tend to have those moments on airplanes a lot, because I'm always like, well, this thing could go down. We could all die. But I feel good on Virgin America right now. Richard Branson will be in my heart as I die. Anything you can do to remind yourself of the fact that the world's going to keep moving, whether or not you write a screenplay or a play or whatever the hell, that helps me. And then, oddly enough, that'll get me to a place where I feel creative again.
I've definitely been in places before I had the idea for this book. I think it was maybe 2 years, 3 years of me like kind of starting a novel and not really being into it and just not knowing what was going to happen next. And I've been through that, and I think something that I realize is that most of my ideas will come to me when I'm like in a random place overhearing someone's conversation, or I see something, and I just have to sort of trust the universe, which sounds corny, but I have to trust the universe that to send me something when it's going to send me something. And until then, I read a lot. And basically, my kids would be fine if I just never wrote anything again. They take up all my time anyway, so there you go. Yeah.
I'm not really afraid of that happening, because I feel like if I stop doing what I do, there's like a million other things that I want to do. But there are times when I have these things that I'm supposed to be doing and I get distracted by Facebook or Twitter. And that's usually when I invite writer and artist friends over and we just sit at a table together and they do their writing, I do my drawing or whatever we're doing, and we chat a little bit, but we're kind of keeping each other accountable. We'll probably still look at Facebook a little, but I don't want anyone seeing how much I look at Facebook, so yeah, that's my answer.
So shame is a good motivator. Shame and fear.
Yeah.
Next question, right over here.
Oh, when you're doing work, like I write during the day just for other stuff, and then when I try to like work on my own writing, I find that it's a hard switch because I feel like burnout from writing for someone else. I mean, maybe earlier in your careers you were doing sort of for hire work or contract work.
Still.
I'm curious, yeah. How do you sort of switch and access your comfort?
I wrote a book called Real Artists Have Day Jobs, and one of the reasons, and other awesome things they don't teach you in school, because real artists do have day jobs, and I'm one of them. So throughout my career, there have been times when I had a book coming out or something cool, or I was on a talk show, or I was on a really groovy podcast, but also I was making time on the plane on the way to whatever to work on my digital copywriting for a brand that was like, can you make this fun? And I'm like... Can you pay me? Yes, I'll make it real fun. I understand that. I'm working on a project right now where I spend 8 hours a day on it. I work on an East Coast schedule with a team there, and then I'm done with that at 4 p.m., and I'm like, what am I going to do? There has to be a break. For me, I need a buffer between those two things. So I'll physically move. I have a standing desk, and then I also have a sitting down desk at my kitchen table. So I'll switch from one to the other, and that will help me. I need a cue. Like, my body and my brain need a cue. I'll take a nap, or I'll go see a friend or something, but when I resume my work, it can't be where I did the contract stuff or the work for hire stuff. It has to be, I have to physically move myself to get into a more creative space.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have to block off time because I teach part-time. And so teaching, of course, just it drains the energy right out of you. So I never go straight from teaching to writing. I tend to block off, you know, a half day here, a half day there. And sometimes I get to write like 0 hours in a week or maybe just a few hours in a week. But, you know, we're all in different places. I mean, most of us have to have a day job. Mm-hmm. And I just give myself the time that I can find. And for me, it's not a whole lot. But for me, there definitely has to be, like Sarah was saying, like a partition of time and activity. And like often I walk to the place where I want to write just to like create that block between the two activities. Yeah.
Right now, I'm doing the cartooning full-time, and I'm doing my own stuff, but in the past, I've definitely had freelance jobs, that like day jobs for copywriting and video games and stuff like that, and it took a long time to figure this out, but I couldn't take on really creative projects and also do my own creative projects because I have the same kind of burnout. So basically, I just changed the nature of my work, the stuff that I would accept, so... It's soul sucking, but completely not creativity sucking to write for advertisement. So I would do that, and that was easy. And then by the time I get home, I'm like, okay, yes, I could work on my stuff. But if it was too creative, you know, and I still sometimes get requests to do comics for other people, and I just don't. I mean, because I know what that means, and I might have a little bit more money, but but then I'll not be doing what I want to do. But I'm lucky that I'm in a position that I could do that, and that wasn't always the case.
I have a friend who gets up at 5. He's got kids. He's got a full-time day job. He gets up at 5, writes for an hour. The kids wake up. He gets them ready for school with his wife and then goes about his day. So for some people, that works really well. I don't think that would work for me very well. I mean, I get up regularly for 7 a.m. conference calls, but, you know, that's from my kitchen table. I can roll out, you know, 6:55, I wake up, and then there. To get up at 5 and write for an hour is, that's a lot. But for some people, that's what they do.
Wow.
The fact that you have kids and do this is very impressive to me, because that's a whole, I mean, there are humans who need you. That's amazing.
Yeah, this book I mostly wrote with just one child.
That's still a big deal.
I don't know if I could do it with two kids, frankly. I don't know.
Do you think, I've heard parents say this to me when I go, well, when do you find time to write? They go, just when they're napping, or I have to. It's mm-hmm. like do or die. If I have 30 minutes that day or that week, that's when I do it.
Yeah, because your kids aren't going to be asking for your next manuscript. Like, it's up to you. You have to do it or not do it, you know. No one's going to go to bed crying because you haven't written your novel.
It's a few.
If you take anything away from tonight, it's that. No one is going to go to bed crying because you didn't write your novel.
Right.
I think it was Sarah that had mentioned at the Women's March, you had noticed that you found other people who are kind of reacting with some anxiety and stuff. And that's something that I noticed as well, too. Like, the crowd was not anything that I had anticipated when I went to the Women's March. And I was surrounded by other women, myself included, who were on the brink of an anxiety attack, but kind of were able to recognize that I'm here for something that's bigger than myself, and just showing up is what's important. Do you guys have any tips for dissenting for people that have anxiety issues, whether it's showing up at an event like that or doing some form of dissent in your own way that doesn't involve going to a large critical mass event like that?
Yeah, I actually wrote something about that day on like Instagram or something. With some sort of meme generator, I don't know. But what I said was, like, don't feel bad if you couldn't be here. Don't feel bad. There's plenty of people I know who have PTSD, like whether they served in the armed forces, they were traumatized when they were very young, sexual assault, like everything you can imagine that leads to post-traumatic stress disorder, that leads to a situation where somebody like has to always sit with their back to the wall, observing all the exits, and where a crowd like that activates everything that's wrong. And yet, these are still people who are present in the world and care and want to participate. So I heard from a lot, when I put up a thing that was like, it's okay, you can dissent and be active in many ways. Today was a party. There's going to be other parties. Today was a group therapy session. It was also very important. It was a demonstration. But the biggest work that happens is often granular. It's calling your congressperson. It's making choices. If you're a hiring manager, it's making choices about inclusivity in the applicant pool that you look at. It's talking to the person next to you at Thanksgiving dinner and having maybe a difficult conversation about some things. It's writing, it's making art, it's running for office. It's a lot of different things. And people felt a lot of, I heard a lot of feedback from people who were like, thank you for saying that. Like, I can barely leave my home. I felt like shit that I couldn't do this. Also, there are also issues with disability access. There's issues of access for marches and things, and they were very inclusive. The organizers did an amazing job, I think, across the board. But there are people who, for very good reasons, cannot be in that situation, and it has nothing to do with human weakness or a moral failing. And so there's a lot of different things you can do. I mean, I've signed up for some newsletters like Michael Skolnick's newsletter, The Movement to Oppose Trump, which is really helpful. There's another one called Signal Boost, which is really helpful. And that gives me, every week, I get like helpful tips and tricks, things I can do. Sometimes it's showing up to a march, but a lot of times it's the more boring stuff, making a phone call, reciting a script to a congressional aide, and then other things too. So there's a lot you can do, I think.
Yeah, I think the marches just galvanize us for the boring stuff.
Yeah.
I think the boring stuff is what matters.
I was pretty anxious about marching, and I almost didn't go
I'd been having recurring nightmares for 2 weeks that I won't talk about what it was because it was really gross, but I don't want to give anyone any ideas. But it was really bad, and the way I ended up curtailing that was going at the end of it where I knew there weren't going to be that many people and staying away from the crowded areas. Mm-hmm. And it's made me really think about the different ways to do activism, and I really think, I mean, I was glad I went because I got over my fear of like my recurring nightmare coming true, but at the end of the day, even though I had a good time, I was like, well, if I were at home working on the databases, I think I could have made more of a difference. And it just got me thinking of all the different things you can do. And actually, I'm talking about with a fellow cartoonist friend about doing a workshop here in LA about the different ways to be an activist, especially through personal storytelling, which I think is really important when you're trying to teach a certain group of people compassion. I mean, there's really only one way to do it is to put them in your shoes. So I think that's a big one that I've been thinking about lately. That's cool.
Time for one final question.
Great.
It's a quick two-parter. When you're done, quote unquote, with something, do you know you're done, or do you have to ask a you know, supportive person, a best friend? And when you're done, how do you let your baby go? I know it's hard.
There's a saying, I forget what playwright said it, who said something to the effect of, a play is never finished, it's abandoned. I don't know who said it. I'm sorry, I should be better read. Garbage. But anyway, that's true. Yeah, it's never, sometimes I'm like, but bam, like it's done. But then inevitably I'll go back and look at it. And I mean, there's so many things in here that, you know, now just a few years later, having sort of, having gotten over my fear of terms that I was afraid of because I was afraid I wouldn't understand them and sound and be smart enough. I used to call it grad school terminology. There's so much stuff that I'm smarter about now. I had never heard of intersectionality before I wrote this. In reading it now with the lens that I have now, thanks to like the reading I've done, the people in my life who love me, who've checked me on shit appropriately, so the things I've learned, I read this now and it's good. It's still fun. But there's language I would have used differently. There are jokes that seem ridiculous to me now, in not a good way. It's still amazing. Someone should option it again. But I think that you do the best that you can, and if you've got an arbitrary deadline to meet, you hit it if you can. I don't think it's ever done, you know. But once it's a book, that's all people are ever going to know. You're not going to get to revise it. So you have to be okay with
that. You can if it's a memoir. Sometimes they let you.
I did, when I recorded the audiobook for this a couple years later, I was like, you know what? That joke's not that funny. We're going to skip that.
Oh, man. I listened to the audiobook. What did I miss out on?
A lot of stuff that wasn't as intersectional as it could have been, Mary Naomi. You got a woke-ass audiobook. That's what you got. At a certain point, you just gotta let it go. You just do, and you pray that people like it, and sometimes they do. What
yeah,
do you think?
I usually find a time when I'm just so sick of it, I can't look at it again. And I actually had the opportunity, because with my first book, it was published like 8 years ago, but then I put it out by myself. I put it out like independently by myself this past year, so that was my opportunity to, if I wanted to, like, go back and rewrite the whole thing better.
That's
but
awesome.
I didn't, because I just couldn't. I just couldn't. So I think there's a lot of value in putting something away for a long time and not looking at it and then going back to it.
Do you read your books again after they come out?
Not really. I mean, I have to for readings, and that's when I sort of revisit it.
Me too. This is the first time I've read from this in a while. Yeah. And I never have read the whole finished version since I, you know, sent the proofs off. Like, I've never.
Right, because I read it like 20,000 times
right.
when I was editing it. So it's basically the same.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, I comb over all my stuff when it comes out. I'm like, oh, especially if someone gives it a bad review or a good review. And I'm like, what do they see? And I'm like, I try to cleanse my mind of it and look at it with a fresh pair of eyes. And that's when I inevitably am like, oh man, everything's wrong in this. I have to just redo everything.
No.
Yes, it's done when the deadline's due. But you know, I have friends who've done memoir who, when it came out in paperback or they did another reprinting, they're like, oh, do you want to change anything? And
yeah, I would love to do a revisionist history memoir where I just like
am charming constantly and like winsome. sort of missed the boat on winsome. What about you, Michelle? Do you look at your stuff after it's out and go, ugh, no.
Yeah, I do cringe for sure. But there is something really interesting about how, you know, you can tell the same story at any point in your life. You'll tell it very differently. So if I go back and look at my book, Valencia, for instance, I wrote that almost in real time when I was 25. And so I can look at that now and be like, oh my God, like so self-involved, so, you know, so many things, so drunk, you know. And if I wrote it now, it would be such a different story. But I think the charm of that book was that it was written by a 25-year-old who was drunk and self-absorbed, who was writing about what happened the night before. And so you just have to let go. And, you know, once a book is done, I feel like it's a little person out in the world, and you just have to let it go. You have to let it find its people, and mm-hmm. it's just like totally detached from you. So I really enjoy the moment that like you're in right now, Shanti, where like you did the work and you can go out and you just like bask in the like, I did the work, I'm reading my great story. Like that's the best. Yeah. But then after that moment passes, I kind of never look at it again. Mm. Yeah. Yeah. Although this boy I was in love with when I was 15 just like flirted with me on the internet recently. It was so weird. You know, he's
are
like,
you going to leave everything? You should.
But then I was just like, what did I write about him in my, because I know I wrote about him. So then I like frantically went, I was like, this is so great that I can go like check. It's like having access to the records of your life in this way. I was like, what did I write about him? You know? And then, but then I'm out of that book that I wrote. I don't have it. So I couldn't remember. then the thrill wore off. It's just like, I got like a little hit of dopamine. Mm-hmm. It was nice.
Cause he's like, I missed out. And you're like, mm-hmm.
Basically. He was like, you know, I was like goth. It was like very goth, you know? And he was like, black eyeliner and stuff too. Now he's like kind of balding and stuff. He was like, you were the black star. And I was like, yes, I was.
That is right. A compliment.
It felt like there was a 15-year-old goth girl inside me that was just like,
yes.
Felt really hell good, yeah. All day. Just had a little spring in my boot. You know. I think that we have got to stop this party, you guys. I'm sorry, but we have books to sign, and we're going to bring the party out into where the books yeah. are. Yeah, clap for these amazing, wonderful people.
Thank you for
so
being
much.
Here.
Sarah Benincasa, Shanti Sekaran, Mari Naomi. Thank you very much, Aloud. Become a member, follow them, come to their amazing events. Paul Beattie's going to be here on February 14th. What? There's your Valentine's Day date.
Ooh.
Right here talking about the sellout. Yes. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Michelle.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Sharon Oxborough, the Estate of Suzanne Aaron, Donna and Martin J. Wolfe, Julia Meltzer, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM. Music by Boya Pongo. Support these free programs by becoming a member of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Visit lfla.org for more information.